Hi, I'm Bill Arnold. Thanks for listening to the podcast from the Early Morning Late Show. Good morning, it's 4 minutes after the hour, and happy Thursday. I say that because we are in the midst of what's going to be here in the upper Midwest, a little bit of a weather change. So beware, just so you know, you're going to want to allow yourself a little extra time and to make sure as the weather gets colder. You know, we had a couple of days of reprieve where we sort of thought, nah, I don't need the jacket, but boy, you'll need more than one today here in the upper Midwest. So the 2018 Open Doors watch list came out, and as no surprise, it says that Christians are most in danger in North Korea. It says that about 50,000 Christians are in North Korean prisons or labor camps for their faith. The Open Door website says it's illegal to be a Christian in North Korea, with believers sent to labor camps or killed if they're discovered. All right, in Seattle, there's a new soda tax that's working out about as well as it did in Chicago when they tried that. I find it interesting. They're slapping on this behavior modification. We will make it nearly impossible for you to enjoy sugary soda by nearly doubling the price overnight. And usually when they're trying to sneak a tax in, they do it slowly. But this time, they just kind of put this whopping tax on. And one of the big box stores put the price literally on their on the right in the store. Said, "Here's the price of the pop. It's $10.99." And then City of Seattle sweetened beverage recovery fee $7.50. Just they put that right on the price tag, just to let people know your new price is now $18.34 for your sody pop. So there has been a lot of pushback from people in Seattle, and I don't blame them. And then in the meantime, Coca-Cola is trying to reinvent themselves. They're coming out with new sleek cans and flavors in the pop to try to make it more appealing to the younger crowd, who they're trying to do their best to not consume so much sugar. So anyway, speaking of sugar, I've got Dr. Peter Kapsner in studio. He has already gotten up this morning. He had his mash and gravy, and now he's in the studio. So we're here to talk to him. We'll be back in just a minute. Good morning, 8 minutes after the hour, a couple sips of coffee. We're ready to have our conversation with Dr. Peter Kapsner. He is a professor here at the University of Northwestern and also at Bethel. Good morning, Peter.
Good morning, Bill.
Yeah, thanks. Let's start with a very good news story. This was out of Dallas, Texas. There was a school, Billy Earl Dade Middle School in South Dallas, and they had breakfast with Dad's Day. And they were a little concerned that there would be a number of students, actually a majority, who may not have a male figure in their life. So a pastor, Don Parrish Jr., went on Facebook and he asked for, hey, be nice if we could get 50 male volunteers to step in. And that morning, 600 men showed up.
Yeah, phenomenal. Just phenomenal to see. And I think what it speaks to is sort of this awareness that we all have that the family fragmentation of the last couple of generations has made an impact on our kids. And I don't know that any of us really know for sure what to do about it. But when somebody offers an opportunity to step in and to be a part of something, it speaks to that. We see it. And this is one way in which we can begin to maybe possibly turn back the tide and meet some of these needs with just young people that have a lot of questions, especially when they're growing up in a one-parent household. Mm-hmm. Even when that one parent is doing as well as they can, and they do, and there's so many people that sacrifice so much for that. But I think we even recognize, even in those situations, other voices in our kids' lives matter.
Mm-hmm. It said in the article, too, that mothers and students were moved to tears after seeing the love their community poured into them.
Yeah.
No surprise.
No. I mean, I think sometimes, you know, we have the five kids at home, and I can't imagine how lonely the journey can be, it's already overwhelming to try to parent with a partner and a spouse and a wife of 20 some odd years, that we can lean into each other. And even then we get confused and we don't know what the next steps are and we don't know where to go. But where I miss some things, she can often pick up some stuff, and where she misses, I just can't imagine doing all of that alone. So I would completely be moved to tears if people were willing to just take their time and come alongside my kids if I was walking that journey alone.
Isn't that the truth? There's a program, and I'm going to have to find out what it is because it escapes my memory right now, but there's a program where a dad physically shows up at the school on a school day.
Yeah, I've seen that.
And just kind of hangs out. And the programs, the schools where that program is in place has much lower truancy, much lower fighting, much lower problems. Just having a male presence.
Yeah.
Isn't that crazy?
It is. And I think it does speak to however we think about these things. There are differences that men and women bring to the table. And if we're absent female figures in our lives, that's going to impact us in some way. And if we're absent male figures in our lives, it's going to impact us. So to have somebody around, and I know that the statistics would bear out that it's typically in single parent households, it's typically female led. And so in this case, to simply have a male around would be a unique opportunity for, I think, some of the young people that are living in a single parent household to experience something different and something in a way that matters.
Mm-hmm. Peter, this was a little story I saw, and I clipped this and talked to Peter about this. And I know you teach a human sexuality class here at the University of Northwestern.
I do.
A well-attended one, by the way.
It is.
I don't think there's an open seat.
Yep.
And it talked about the difference between the male and the female brain, and that men have a sexual pursuit area that's 2.5 times larger than the one in the female brain. And they were talking about testosterone, and they said if it were coffee, they said a 9-year-old boy would be the equivalent of getting about a cup a day, but a 15-year-old boy would be getting the equivalent of nearly 2 gallons a day.
Yeah, and it's an amazing stat when you read that to me just a couple of minutes ago. And I think then when you tie that into just even single parent household situations where there's this tremendous physiological event happening for our young people, and they often don't have other people in their lives that can help explain and come around and here's what you're going to begin to experience. And even as you experience these testosterone washes, here's how you can navigate life so that you don't go to inappropriate places with that. I will say this, in the 10 years or so that I've taught these kinds of courses on sexuality and gender, I can't think of too many instances among the hundreds of students where they say, you know, somebody was really there for me at 15 when these things were going on and we could talk about this stuff and I understood it and I was able to navigate it.
Right.
They're mostly left to the bus rides in the locker rooms to figure out what's happening in my body at these points.
Yeah.
And so 15-year-olds leading 15-year-olds doesn't often end well.
No. And talk about these 15-year-olds that would be stepping into such a sexualized culture.
Yeah. And that's the part of it is that I think it was a few years ago that I kind of had a light bulb go on and had to ask the question. So you experience all of this sexualization even from a very early age. And I think we get this sense that sometimes, and I've seen Christian books written on this where it will say things like men are just sexual hunters. That's the way they're designed. And so they're going to think certain things. They're going to desire certain things. It's just part of the deal. And their best option is to turn away when those things happen.
Mm-hmm.
And I understand that on some level, but I think we can explore more deeply on that subject by saying, but hormones are neutral. They're not necessarily attached to one thing or another. We teach ourselves what they get attached to, and living in a very over-sexualized culture and without the voices that can help us navigate those really hard seasons as adolescents, we naturally begin to see our hormones get attached to things that are wildly inappropriate. And then the testosterone and the objectification of women or men or whatever it all is becomes really confusing really fast. But it doesn't mean that just because you're having a testosterone rush that now you're going to objectify women. We're sort of taught that in many subtle ways throughout all of our growing up years.
Peter, how do you think the church is doing in terms of addressing this with youth groups and things like that?
Yeah, it's...
I mean, you've got young children, and you've got an 18-year-old Caleb. He was in the studio, fine young man.
Yeah, and...
What was it like just navigating him through that?
Yeah, I think what I'm seeing, and again, having only 10 years of perspective, but I will say there seems to be an openness and an awareness in churches more so now than there was 10 years ago. But I would say that they just oftentimes don't know how to start the conversation. And so I'd be curious, actually, I'm working with the church this entire spring in a variety of situations, met with them this last week around their youth group and and going to do 5 weeks with their young people on sexuality, going to be in the pulpit a few times talking about these things. So I don't know for sure how it's going to go, but it was really interesting to be a part of a church. And it's getting increasingly more usual that churches want to break open the box. And I'll be really curious how it goes this spring as we talk about these things.
Mm-hmm. Because as the culture has become heightened in terms of the Me Too campaign and all of the things, the nonsense that goes on in Hollywood. There's also, with that comes some fallout that starts to trickle down with, even the natural socialization process of normal flirting that young men do. And how is that? How do you express that?
Yeah.
And just say, hey, I want to, meet a girl. So
I think that's going to be the subtle thing that might be more or as problematic in a different way in the end, because I think to bring all of this horrible stuff that's been happening in the dark into the light mm-hmm. has been a phenomenal and so long overdue, obviously, at every level moment. But the question comes is, as you identify the problem and begin to address the problem, what ways are you addressing the problem? I mean, you can see the disease, but then there's going to be any number of ways to approach the disease. And I think that's going to be one of the things that we may not attend to as fully as we need to in these years ahead, is what's going to be the remedy for what has been, and are we going to create more problems with some of the remedies sometimes?
Yeah, good point.
And I think that's we just don't think about those things. We're just glad the disease is out, and it should be. But, now we have an opportunity to create some wholeness and healing, and that doesn't always take shape that way in our culture.
Yeah, tricky subject.
Yep,
Peter, let me
sure.
take a break. We'll come back more with Dr. Peter Kapsner in just a minute. I'm playing air piano right now.
You know, Bill, I like this. I mean, this is walk-up music. I mean, I've been stuck for a while. The U2 stuff has not been working for me. But this is
Billy Preston.
This is phenomenal.
Yeah.
I can roll with this stuff.
Cool.
This is great.
Let's make it official. Pete Kapsner's song, Nothing From Nothing, by Billy Preston. Done and done.
I didn't see the title of the piano
trust
thing.
Me, you just walked into that
I
one,
totally
Kelly.
Did. Now I got to, yeah, that's 2018 theme right there. So there we
nothing
go.
Nothing from nothing leaves nothing. Boy,
love
isn't
it.
That about perfect?
Perfect name for this segment. I love it.
Yeah. Well, I find this of great interest, Peter, because, we always talk about what would Jesus do? And then I always say on the flip side, what would Satan want? Satan would want to take God's word, twist it.
Yeah,
And maybe make only 3% of it inaccurate, because that way you believe the majority of it.
Yeah,
you wouldn't make 97% inaccurate, because that would throw up a red flag. But 3%, you'd go, is that right?
Yeah.
So here's a story that comes out. I'm going to try to talk to several people about this, but Swarthmore College is offering a course in Queering God.
Saw that.
You did see that?
I did.
Okay.
Yep.
So we're talking about, I know you talk about gender and sexuality here at University of Northwestern. Obviously, you come from a solid biblical perspective. And here's obviously a liberal college. But again, their design is talking about I don't even like saying the words.
Yeah, and I think it makes such a good point about that 97%, 3% bit of it. And we talk about these things in class that Satan shows up in two forms in the biblical text, and one is as the roaring lion. And I think, as we've even talked about at times in the last year here, is it's pretty obvious when a lion is coming what you should do. You should run. You're not going to engage with that. But it's when Satan comes as the angel of light, where everything looks pretty and looks beautiful, and it seems like that is a helpful direction to go. But as you walk those paths out, it's wreaking havoc on your soul. That gets really hard to figure out. And as Satan being described as the father of lies, there is that deceit. I mean, deceitfulness is never more destructive than when it is that real subtle form of it, because then you can't sniff it out and you can't smell it. And so even relative to this class, I think there's a sense in which, wow, we're so enlightened and we're so progressive and we're moving forward. But in order to get to that place in that class, you have to start by deconstructing the reliability of the Bible as you have maybe had it, and you have to say it is not, the documents that it came from aren't reliable, so we need to begin to shift and bend it so that it's more appropriate for our culture today. And I've been, you know, in academia for, I don't know how many years now, but I've seen those, what happens when you say the Bible in its current form is not reliable. Mm-hmm. Then from there, all the barriers are gone. You can begin to twist it and take it in whatever way. And you start thinking, we just have to speak a different truth to our culture now. And you can shift the words of the Bible so it's more palatable somehow or more interesting mm-hmm. for our culture, instead of saying, wait a second, maybe we need to look at it and bend the arc of our lives towards the beauty and truth of the text.
I like that. So, Peter, earlier in the show, I had Greg Howe on from InterVarsity Fellowship, and I'm curious because he deals with kids in college settings.
Yeah.
And he was talking about the need that we have as college students and as adults out in the regular world to develop a trusting friendship with people who are not believers.
Yeah.
And you can sometimes live in a bubble with your Christian and church friends, and turns out you really don't have many trusting relationships with non-believers. And he says that's kind of step one to evangelism.
Yeah, gosh, what a beautiful point. And it calls to mind just the deficits I have in my own life of just trusted friendships in general. And yeah, I went with a friend of mine to the Timberwolves game when they played the Cavaliers this last week, and we've been friends for 20 some odd years, and we were able to say to each other, the longer that I go on in life, the more I value having just even a single trusted friend. So yeah. it's just tricky on that. And mm-hmm. then I have to ask myself, why do I struggle having trusted friends in general? And then have to say, what does it mean to have trusted friends that aren't Christians? Because as you've said, it is through friendship and in our relationships that we begin to press into each other. And that's where faith can be shared, I think, far more effectively than standing on a bench and shouting at people. It's in the fabric of our relationships. And I have to ask myself the question, I don't even know for sure what it means to have really good trusted friends a lot of the time.
That's an honest response. But as he was talking about trying to make yourself vulnerable to people, mm-hmm. who may be lost,
yep.
because you're trying to develop trust, and part of that is you want them to trust you, but you have to trust them as well.
You really do.
And that makes it difficult. And I'm just wondering about your class, your college students that you talk to. Do you have any idea where they're at in that on that continuum?
Yeah, I from a trust standpoint, mm-hmm. certainly what is the most common experience that I run into is they would describe moments in their life in which they experienced some kind of relational pain, whether it was teasing in the
yes.
classroom, whether mm-hmm. it was when mom or dad came in and said, I'm sorry, we're going to live in separate homes, or whatever it all is. There's so many different forms the pain takes. And we talk often in class about how I watch my son or my daughter come down the stairs at very early ages, and they just have this beautiful twinkle in their eye and everything. But you can start seeing when those first flickers of pain cross them because they have been hurt. And so the boundaries come up really easily. And I get it. And so to develop trust, and especially with somebody who may not be a believer and you think we might be at odds with each other, to really... And you can't open the door of trust because you're going to use it as a currency to somehow save them. Mm-hmm. You just have to be a trusting person. And you can't use it as a technique or people sniff it out. And so I think you have to get yourself anchored from a different voice. And that's the voice of our Heavenly Father that speaks that peace. And regardless of what happens in the relationship, I'm going to risk myself because I have a voice from heaven that is anchoring me in peace. And that way, even if this starts going wonky, I'm not trying to develop my sense of peace from the other person. And when I get to that point is when I can finally trust, like throwing out there myself a much more vulnerable way.
Mm-hmm. I don't want you to break any kind of confidence, and I'm sure you wouldn't. But
sure.
are there some real questions that your students have been looking to get answered that continues to remain a real obstacle to their faith?
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm sure that's true.
You know, and you would think, Bill, I think that you would start thinking about here, what are the theological questions that trip them up? And mm-hmm. it's not that. It's along the lines of what we were just talking about. We will have a whole class devoted mostly to one of the central questions of the human soul is, do you see me and do you like what you see? And when I say that, that crosses both gender, male, female, that people are asking these questions. Do you really see me and do you like what you see? And that trips up everything because then they don't even think that God sees them and likes what God sees. They sort of live in these places where they're trying to appease God and prove to God that they have what it takes and all of that.
Mm-hmm.
And so that has been a central question that as I've brought that up class after class and year after year, students say, yeah, I don't feel seen. And I certainly don't know that somebody would actually like me.
Ouch.
Yeah.
That's really hard to hear. We've got just a minute left. When circumstances come into your life and they're so crushing that you can't really see anything anymore, So you can't see if you're of value. You can't see if people like you because circumstances have crushed you.
Yeah.
And then you even start, I had a letter from a listener who said, I'm even starting to doubt that God can save me.
Yeah.
You feel your spirits get so destroyed, don't they?
And they do.
You've got to return to fellowship and church and the word, and you have to get yourself back where speaking the truth to yourself and feeding yourself and getting other people to speak truth into your life.
Yeah, and it goes back to the very first thing that we talked about this morning as just one of the places where that can happen, where these 600 men showed up and began to speak. Hopefully, I wasn't there, obviously, but I would guess some of what they're doing is their simple presence was speaking truth into the lives of these people that maybe just desperately needed it. And I don't think you can just pull yourself out of those cycles. There's too much talk that we have internally. So
I know those students were there saying, someone is seeing me. Someone is noticing me. Peter, stick around. We've got Ann Bradley up next. I'd love for you to stick around and join the conversation.
Great.
27 minutes after the hour. We'll be back in just a minute. Good morning. 24 minutes until the top of the hour. Bill Arnold with you. Still in studio is Dr. Peter Kapsner. He's along with me this morning. Using our authority in prayer, John Eldridge has these interesting things to say about our identity and how it affects our prayer life.
How do you see yourself in the prayer relationship? Are you the orphan who's just standing outside the mayor's mansion hoping that somebody's going to toss you a scrap now and then? Like, do your prayers sound like orphan prayers? Or are you the son? Are you the daughter? And you have immediate, intimate access, right? To God, who loves you dearly. Just beginning with identity, how do you see yourself? And then the next step is, and what are you looking at when you pray? Because what we typically look at is the crisis. We typically look at the illness. We look at the impending divorce. We look at the lost. We look at our checkbook, right? And when you look at the crisis, your faith will fail. What we're urged to do is look at God, or look at something that reminds you of God, at least.
If you want to hear that full interview, head over to myfaithradio.com. John Eldridge is the author and president of Ransom Heart. So Moving Mountains in the search engine, or John Eldridge, will get you to that interview. Next up, Dr. Ann Bradley's with us. Be back in a minute.
Are you finding it nearly impossible to get through to your teen? Hi, I'm Mark Gregston with Parenting Today's Teens. It's tough to reach your teen when he's got his headphones on all the time and all you get back is a grunt or one-word answer. But don't allow those obstacles to deter you. This is no time to back off. Find a way to engage your teen with funny stories from your past. Let them share in the humor of some of your dumb mistakes. Make sure they've heard about your family history and the reason you turned out like you have. These unfiltered moments will produce esteem, stability, and a sense of purpose. Mom and Dad, quit lecturing and tell some good old stories.
Learn how to navigate your child's turbulent teen years with Mark Gregson's free course. Get instant access by visiting freeparentingcourse.com.
Connecting faith to life every day.
Our days can often be very emptying, especially when you work like 9 to 5 or something like that, and having somebody kind of speak life into you is very filling, and I think we all need that after working.
I agree with starting out your day with something you could sink your teeth into. For sure, something solid. And maybe you do your personal devotions in the morning, or maybe you do it at night. So then listening in the morning would be a great way to kick it off.
Thanks for listening to Faith Radio.
Good morning. It's 20 minutes until the top of the hour. Hopefully, we'll be able to connect with Dr. Ann Rathbone Bradley. Coolest name ever.
It is the coolest name ever. It really is. I've ponder changing my middle name just to make it
just
sound
to be
way
Rathbone.
Better. Because yeah, I got nothing in my middle name. So
what do you have in the middle name? Yeah?
Yeah, it's Braun. I mean, Braun
what?
Is so, it's Braun. It's this crazy
like
German
B-R-A-W-N?
Thing.
A-W-N?
Yeah. It's like the old coffee maker stuff. I mean, there's just nothing of sort of pizzazz with that middle name. It really doesn't roll off the tongue.
No, I understand that.
Yeah.
So Ecclesiastes 10:11 says, if a snake bites before it is charmed, the charmer receives no fee.
Really?
Did you know that?
I didn't. That may be the most interesting and productive thing I learn all day.
That's why I brought it up.
Well, and there's got to be some kind of spiritual significance to that. So I'm gonna think about that.
Yeah, I think you should. Again, we were talking about earlier this morning about evangelism and how when we start the new year, I always say there's a lot of time when you can say, I've got a fresh, clean slate. And I had a former pastor that said, you can always sort of tell the health of someone spiritually if they can do two things. If they can talk about something that the Holy Spirit brought to them through their personal study in Scripture that maybe is new and fresh in a way that they've never looked at before. And if they can talk about that, that's a good thing. And they can also then pinpoint the person, the place, and the time they had a chance to personally share their faith. If you can't name either of those two things, maybe things have gotten a little flat.
Yeah, boy, what a great statement that is. And I think there's times in my past where, and you probably have experienced this too, where a passage of Scripture was very meaningful to me maybe 15, 20 years ago, and then you come back to it 15 to 20 years later, and it hits you in an entirely different but really important way. And so it's this sort of living, breathing text and the way that it intersects our lives at important times. And so it just, it tells me that God is present and God is real and able to speak to us in those moments. And that's where it becomes a dynamic, life-giving kind of thing. And yeah, I think your willingness to talk about these things is, I get it. It can be awkward and hard, but there's a lot of things that I really value in my life that I don't have any trouble talking about. Mm-hmm. And so the question is how do we bring those things to the table? I know we don't want to be off-putting as we talk about them, but I don't want to be silenced either just because I'm scared of the awkwardness.
Mm-hmm. And I had a guest on last week talking about, he's written a book about being uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And I thought, you know, he's a 28 or 29-year-old guy, and he was saying that he finds himself often in places where I am. Brett McCracken was his name, and he was talking about when he and his wife are in a place where they're uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
They're usually always somehow encouraged to grow in their faith. And, you know, we just by nature, by default, don't like discomfort.
Yeah, when I'm comfortable, I'm not thinking, man, how can I grow?
Oh,
and
nor can
so
I.
It really is that discomfort that asks some different questions.
Yeah. Well, we've been able to get Dr. Ann Bradley on our studio line. I think she's now available. Good morning, Ann.
Good morning, Ben. How are you?
Good. And I still have Peter Kapsner in studio. He was my previous guest, and I asked him to stick around, and he said yes. So he is here in the studio as well. Peter, say hi to Ann.
Good morning, Ann.
Good morning, Peter. How are you?
Well, I'm doing pretty well. It's nice to speak with you.
His middle name is Braun, and he's jealous of yours, which is Rathbone, so...
We could combine those.
Yeah.
Rathbron.
Rathbron would be way better. Bill brought it up again this morning, and again, I feel deficient about my middle name.
Yeah,
so,
we all do.
Yeah, we do.
You know, when your middle name is Rathbone, everyone feels deficient.
No, everybody, that's the standard. So
now, Ann, I should probably do a little bit better job setting you up, although our listeners know who you are, but you're with the Institute for Faith, Work, and Economics, and you're an economist. So we have an opportunity today to talk about economic news, which, from what I can tell, seems pretty good.
Yeah, I think there's some really good things on the horizon as well. This tax reform bill that's working its way out, I think, is really positive and optimistic. And the reason that economists would take that position is that these tax cuts allow employers and private citizens who are not, running a business to invest more in their families, in their homes, in other investments, and that's really the engine of economic growth. And so the problem with excessive burdensome taxes is that it forces really all of us on different margins to give up what we could be doing other things with, and those other things involve, making investments in growing our business, which allows us to employ more people. And so this is really, I think, good news. If you look at the Federal Register, the growth of regulations, the growth of taxes, and this is not just, you know, under the last president, but over the last 100 years, the size and scope of government has been growing and growing. And if you're going to grow government, you have to grow taxes to pay for that government.
Mm-hmm.
And at some point, it really starts to crowd out private activity. And that private activity is where the economic growth comes from. So this, I think, is good news.
Mm-hmm. And since 1972, since they've been recording this, this is the lowest black unemployment in our country's history since they've been recording it in 72, which is now, I think, at 6.8. The Hispanic unemployment is also close to a record low at 4.9. Why is there not more cartwheeling going on in mainstream media?
Okay, I love this question. And I think this gets really to the heart of the problem, which is that I think all of us have a political agenda. And we tend to feel very personally wedded to that agenda. And so when the reality might tell us something different, instead of investigating it, we ignore it. And I think both the right and the left, frankly, are guilty of this. So we all need to say, okay, you know, let me look at what does the world look like and why? And, you know, this is really optimistic news because what this means is there's higher levels of employment among minorities who are typically been suffering high levels of unemployment, then we want to say, okay, what made this happen and how can we foster it? How can we fuel it? Because again, what we want for people who are, you know, kind of unemployed is for them to be able to get long, stable jobs that have, you know, kind of income growth and things like this attached to them. And I would say another thing is we need to be really careful about politically attaching the success or failure of this. So the president, No president controls jobs. No president controls the stock market. So you'll often hear, I mean, Trump does this, Obama did it, so I'm not blaming one or the other. They all do it. But they say, look at me, you know, I've reduced unemployment. Well, unemployment, you know, is not directed by the president of the United States. Sure, the president can affect how easy or hard it is for people to get jobs, but they don't directly control employment. So I think these are signs of economic growth. These are signs of, you know, the economy starting to get a little bit better, a little bit brighter, people being able to provide for their families. It's really exciting. But
yeah.
You're right. We need to cartwheel this.
Yeah,
we
I know.
Need to champion this.
And yeah. Let me take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Dr. Ann Bradley from the Institute for Faith, Work, and Economics. Be back in a minute. It is 10 minutes until the top of the hour. I have Dr. Ann Bradley on our studio line from the Institute for Faith, Work, and Economics. You know, Ann, people say that some of these this tax reform is for the rich people. But it seems that, for example, American Airlines, they have 127,000 employees that each got $1,000.
Mm-hmm.
That's $130 million dollars that the company is forced has given away. And also, they increased their fleet investment with Boeing. And on top of that, they donated another $5 million to charitable causes. Seems like a good idea.
Exactly. Exactly. I think we view it as, you know, the rich pay the most taxes. I mean, we have a progressive tax system. So when you get tax cuts, you know, they're going to affect the rich in different ways that they affect other people, depending, and you know, on kind of the way the plan is enacted. But so that doesn't mean, though, to your point, to your example, that doesn't mean that the rich are the only ones benefiting. It means that people who have these enormous billions of dollars of investments tied up in the economy can do more. And as we've talked about before on the show, jobs are a cost. They are a cost to an economy. You know, somebody has to pay me to get me to come to work. And not only that, but they pay for benefits and they pay for me to take 2 weeks off a year and they pay for me to have sick days. It's expensive to employ people. So if we want more jobs, we need a more productive economy so that employers can afford to do the things you just said. And I love the last part of your example, which is that we have more money to be generous with. We can donate more. If we're making more and we're able to keep more, then we're able to be generous with more in ways that we personally see fit, whether that's our neighborhood, our church, our community, whatever it is. So this is just really exciting news all the way around. And it doesn't just stay at the top with the Bill Gateses of the world. It affects all of us.
And then, and Anne, I think that that leads to a follow-up question, too. In what I hear from some of the messaging that those who would oppose the tax cuts would say that this is going to create even a wider income gap. It's not going to resolve it. It's actually going to create a much wider division between the have and the have not. Is that consistent with your experience, or is that just really well done messaging at this point?
I think it's provocative messaging. I think that, you know, if you look back, to, we can go back to Shakespeare, right? This kind of pitting the rich against the poor is certainly not a new idea. But I think politicians in particular, the media, maybe they tend to latch onto this because it's easy. People buy into it. We don't want the rich to have more than us because if it's unjust. I think we can all get behind that. So I think it's an easy marketing campaign, but it just doesn't bear out. I mean, look at the numbers. Hispanic unemployment is down. Black unemployment is down. What does that mean? That means that people who were previously, you know, had no income or very little income perhaps, now have an income. So that's actually going to shrink the gap. It's not going to widen the gap. If you're getting more people working and more people getting, you know, on-the-job training and things like this, then more they're going to grow their skills. That's going to raise their wages. So actually what you're saying is that that should start to narrow, not expand. And that's, you know, that's the good news. And I also think in this inequality debate, we really get caught up in, this disparity, this gap. And that's really not what matters. The difference between what Bill Gates makes and what I make is irrelevant. What matters is that the people who aren't Bill Gates can, you know, can they provide for their families? Can they get medicine when they're sick? Can they put food on the table? So it's not the gap. It's the level of income that matters. It's not your ranking in the income. It's the level. And I think we need to shift the conversation to be about that. It's really, the thing we care about is not inequality, it's poverty. And they're very different things, but we tend to kind of lump them into the same conversation.
Yeah, during the break, and Peter and I were talking about when more people are employed, then there's a chance, too, that crime goes down.
Absolutely. Crime goes down. Kind of gang membership goes down. There's so many positive effects in your community, in your neighborhood. People have an incentive to get more education now. I don't just mean four-year college, but apprenticeships and all sorts of things. People start making personal investments in their long-run futures. And when people are joining gangs, they're not doing that. And so there's a real kind of virtue that's underneath all of this, which is that if we want to live in this kind of society, we have to be making productive investments, not just in ourselves, but then taking those investments and reinvesting them in the community.
Mm-hmm.
And so unemployment, you know, hurts that, but employment helps that. So I think, you know, there's a moral factor underneath all of this that we really need to consider.
Yeah, and just a couple minutes left. What kind of trends should we be watching?
In 2018, mm-hmm. I think what we need to look at, in terms of the economy at large, I really want to keep my finger on kind of this idea that we're going to deregulate more. President Trump has been talking about that. Again, I think this is what hurts people in the middle class and in the lower income brackets the most, because they don't have high powered attorneys to lobby for them. So I want to really, you know, I'm hopeful about it, but I want to watch that. I also think we need to watch interest rates. They've remained low for a really long time, so I think we need to watch what the Fed's going to do. So there's some really interesting things there. I'm very optimistic, so I think things are moving in the right direction. I think if we can stay on the path that we're on, it's the best hope for people who are, you know, kind of living at the bottom of the income distribution.
Mm-hmm.
I think charitable giving is going to go up. So I want to watch that as well and see, you know, kind of see where we're headed. So, you know, it's not kind of Pollyanna, but I do think that we have good reasons to enter this year feeling pretty good about economic conditions, that they can go in the right direction if we keep doing the right thing.
Yeah. And always a pleasure. Love having you on the show. Thank you so much for consistently always making so much sense.
Thanks, Bill. Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure.
You bet. It's 3 minutes until the top of the hour. We'll take a short break and wrap up the big show. Be back in a minute. Thank you so much to Dr. Ann Rathbone Bradley and Dr. Peter Kapner, who was nice enough to stick around in the studio and keep me company.
I had a very engaging conversation, as always, with Ann, and just I've been sort of pondering the inequality, poverty differences she was talking about. But along with that, I've been pondering the snake charming deal.
Yeah.
And I tried to find a lot of insight in the text. I searched the Apocrypha. I couldn't find some things there. So I'm going to take some time in my quiet time this morning to really wonder about this charming stuff.
Ecclesiastes 10:11. If a snake bites before it is charmed, the charmer receives no fee.
I'm taping it on my steering wheel. I'm going to meditate on this one today.
Peter, thanks so much. And thanks to all of our listeners. Blessings on your day. Have a great day. We love you. We'll see you tomorrow. Thanks for listening to the Early Morning Late Show podcast. These conversations are available because of your prayerful and financial support. Make a gift now at myfaithradio.com. To avoid missing future editions of the Early Morning Late Show, subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend and grow the impact of the Early Morning Late Show. Connecting.